Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, John Carney chats about his new musical comedy starring Paul Rudd, Power Ballad, as well as his highs and lows with the movie Once. We look at the emergence of new Hollywood in the 60s with movies like Bonnie Clyde and Chinatown, ahead of a new season at the IFI. And as always, all the new TV and movies you'll want to stream or skip or go see in your multiplex or your regular cinema. You can email the show screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. It's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. I got a bit staccato-y there. I have no idea why. Maybe it's the heat. Yes, it has been, up until recently, a very warm week and a wonderfully warm week. I had a strange week in the fact that I had something in my life I've never really had before and will never hopefully be having again. I had to sell my wife's old car. My wife got a car, a new car, newish car, you know, secondhand new car. And I had to get rid of her old car for reasons I won't bore you with. And I went online to do it. That whole world of selling things online is a different world. You know, when you put contact details out there and people can get in touch with you various ways to inquire about the thing you're selling, it's weird, you know? And people, in my experience, and it was only 3 days, borderline abuse you for the price you have things up at. By the time someone actually came to take the car and give me money for it, I possibly would have given it to them for free. Online selling is not for me. It's a whole different world and it's not one I plan to ever return to. So there you go. That's what was occupying me this week. I'm glad to be rid of my wife's old car, and to the person who bought it, happy driving. This week in TV, I was watching this.
Can you please, like, stop and just, come on, have a beer with me?
I've got too much to do. And I'll fall asleep. I'm old and broken.
You are not old.
Well, I am broken. I need to get this place set up or else Carl's not gonna let Hazel sleep here.
That's crazy.
My ex's lawyer is, like, super aggressive and mine got his job because he's good at softball.
Relax, yeah. You're doing great.
Well, that is untrue.
Oh, it is true. You just have to push through this beginning. Beginnings are always the hardest part, right?
No. Endings are the hardest part. Beginnings are, you know, full of promise. Like maybe, I don't know, just this one time, find love or happiness. Maybe even just a $20 bill on the ground.
Yeah, now that is a clip there from a show on Apple TV, which launched last week or early this week. I can't be sure. There are now 3 episodes up there. It's dropping weekly. It's called Maximum Pleasure Guaranteed. Yes, that sounds slightly sexual, and it is slightly sexual in that we have Tatiana Maslany, who a lot of people know from Orphan Black, playing Paula, who's a woman whose life is kind of falling apart. She's working as a fact checker in this kind of publishing company. She wants to get a promotion. She's newly divorced or separated from her husband and is going through part of a custody battle with her young, sprightly daughter. And she befriends or employs the services of a cam boy. And for those of you who don't know, because I wasn't too sure, not having used the services of many cam boys in my time, a cam boy, or a cam woman, I suppose is the same thing, is someone who will go online and chat to you and do other things with you for an agreed fee. So she's having this kind of friendly relationship with this guy called Trevor, who's a cam boy. And, you know, getting her jollies from talking to him, both emotionally and sexually. So far, so good. Then one night, he is supposedly taken hostage and kidnapped, and she's told she has to pay a ransom. A police officer comes in and suggests this may be a scam. I'm not going to tell you much more than that. That all happens in the first episode, so it's not a spoiler and it's in the trailer, but I won't tell you any more than that. But this is a brilliant thriller. It reminded me of something, despite the kind of very modern online sex thing, like a 1990s thriller in a really good way. And it is, I keep reading reviews of it that are describing it as propulsive, keeps giving and keeps going. And this drama really, really does. It changes the whole time. And what she's involved with, Tatiana's character, Paula, the stakes keep ratcheting up. And there are twists and turns, but they never lose the plot. They stay propulsive, engaging. The only bad news is it's dropping weekly. Now, I have all 10 episodes because I'm a very important person, but you're going to have to binge it in weeks or wait till it's over in another 7 weeks' time. This is one of the best shows I've seen in a long time in terms of just sheer entertainment. It is a brilliant, brilliant thriller. It really is. Kind of grimily shot. It's fantastic. I'm talking about Maximum Pleasure Guaranteed on Apple TV. The show of the week, if not the month, maybe even the year so far. Absolutely brilliant. Another show that is doing quite well on the old streamer Netflix is The Burrows, which stars Alfred Molina, brilliant English actor, who reluctantly joins a retirement community, a pretty fancy one in the desert. You know, one of these retirement communities in the middle of America in a kind of pleasant desert setting with all mod cons, which is kind of expensive. He doesn't want to be there, but his wife has passed away and he is kind of caught in the contract. But then when he gets there, he realizes he's probably going to find some friendship. There are people like Gina Davis, who's another resident and teacher there. The great Bill Pullman is in there as well. And he starts to kind of like living there. Now, the rub in all this is that there is kind of an alien slash supernatural presence living in one of these communities now. But they all kind of band together to fight the nastiness that might be behind the walls. This is executive produced by the Duffer Brothers, who gave us Stranger Things. A lot of people are really enjoying this. It's getting largely positive reviews. I found it okay. I'll tell you what the problem I had with it was. As a human drama and a tale of kind of people who've lived a while going into a new part of their life and maybe not wanting to retire and not wanting to be old, even though there's nothing they can do about it, or certainly not wanting to be older, it works as a nice piece of drama. I think the kind of tandem storyline of this supernatural element didn't really do it for me. Now, that's just me. Some people are loving this, so I want to tell you that I may be in smallish minority here. Well, not that small. It's getting mixed reviews, but lots of people are loving it. I'm talking about The Burrows on Netflix. There's 8 parts there. I think it's okay. You're certainly not going to hate it or anything like that, and it will keep you entertained. It's not brilliant, though. As I say, I just didn't find the two storylines worked for me. It's a nice human drama, and in a way I'm not sure they needed the supernatural element, but I guess that they thought they did, and the Duffer Brothers would know more than I do. So that is The Burrows, now streaming on Netflix. I'm giving it a so-so, but lots of people are enjoying it. And finally, we're going to be talking about a big new movie this week called Power Ballad, but there is a smaller movie out this week in select cinemas that I really liked. Here's a little flavor of it.
Graduation!
Why don't you ever say something?
When you keep a secret about something for so long, it becomes a part of you.
When I was your age, I couldn't be the person that I wanted to be. And that kind of thinking can really eat you up as a kid. I just didn't want you to be raised the way that I was raised.
How did I raise such a normal girl?
Huh? Where did I screw up?
You really want me to go down the list? Because we'll probably miss the party.
That is a clip of a movie called Fairyland. And the Fairyland is kind of a euphemistic title because it's the repatriation, if I can use that phrase, of a homophobic insult about what certain people in 1970s and 80s San Francisco called the part of San Francisco that had a very out and proud gay community in a time when there were very few places in the world, if anywhere, that had such a place. This is based on the memoir of a lady called Alicia Abbott. And her father was a well-known poet from the 70s and 80s in San Francisco called Steve Abbott. It's based on her memoir called Fairyland. Steve Abbott, played brilliantly in this by Scoot McInerney, was a poet, and his wife died in a car crash. And instead of kind of giving his daughter up to the in-laws, he took her to San Francisco and kind of came out and embraced his homosexuality, yet tried to be a parent to Alicia. And It's a beautiful movie. He's not always a great dad, Steve Abbott in this, the poet. He tries, but he's conflicted by kind of wanting to live his own newly embraced gay life and also being a parent. And he places too much independence on the young child and insists on her getting the bus to school when she's clearly far too young to do, brings home some lovers and basically sits her in front of the TV while he entertains them. Yet at the same time, he does seem to care deeply about her and brings her to poetry readings and wants to have her experience a life lived less ordinary. I thought this was delightful. The second half of the movie kind of moves into this a story of the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco in the 80s. I thought the whole thing was beautifully told. The dad isn't that nice at times, but at other times he really is. Nessa Doherty, who you may remember from Coda as the slightly older version of the daughter, is absolutely brilliant in it and kind of becomes parent to her father as the movie goes on. I thought it was a brilliant study of kind of, you know, the life you want to lead, what it's like to be a parent, what it's like to be a child to a sometimes selfish parent. Absolutely delightful movie. Very sad at times, very sweet, very poignant, beautifully shot. If you've ever been to San Francisco, it just screams those, you know, high-hilled streets. Absolutely beautiful. Shots of the Golden Gate Bridge. The music by Michael Penn is delightful. Fairyland in select cinemas from this Friday, the 29th of May. Absolutely delightful. Up next, the great John Carney talks to me about his new movie, Power Ballad. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now opening in cinemas this weekend is Power Ballad, which sees down on his luck wedding singer Rick, played by Paul Rudd, form an unlikely friendship with an internationally renowned boy band member called Danny Wilson, played by Nick Jonas. The partnership turns sour, however, when Danny, determined to launch a credible solo career at whatever cost, steals one of Rick's original tunes. The song becomes a smash. Danny claims full credit, leaving Rick seeking out revenge and recognition. It's set in Ireland and partially in Los Angeles. It was directed and co-written by one of our greatest living filmmakers in the form of John Carney, who hopefully you know previously gave us the wonderful Once, Sing Street, Begin Again, and the underrated Flora and Son from 2023, which we spoke to him for. And of course, all those years ago, he wrote and directed a little show called Bachelor's Walk. I'm delighted to say John joins me now. John, how are you?
I'm very well after that splendid introduction. My God, is that me you're talking about?
I was up all night writing that.
Well, I like underrated. I'll take that.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to Flora and some, but I want to talk to you about Power Ballad and big picture stuff. And forgive me if you've been asked this a million times on the run you're doing, but people know you write about musicians all the time and we've grown to love that about you. But it occurs to me you write a lot about hurt musicians, musicians feel they've been badly treated. I mean, maybe all humans feel hurt about something, but do you think most musicians have gripes about, no matter how successful they are?
That's actually a great question, because you're right, and it's something that I have not self-identified. I've never, you know, set out to rebalance anything like that, or to like get revenge, or but it's a good question, and I do think that maybe what you're kind of getting at there is a sense that music is very hard to kind of own or to quantify in those kind of terms. So maybe, I mean, it's really interesting now what you say. I have met disgruntled musicians more so than in other areas of life now that I think about it. And I wonder, is it a mix of that and a mix of, you know, the 30 years, 40 years of training that, like, for example, a jazz guy will undergo, and then, you know, 20 minutes of recording once a week for a couple of hundred euro, or a small gig, or a, you can understand why the input of work doesn't necessarily equate with the sort of remuneration or credit.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think it was Billy Joel who said, it's a larcenous business. And most young musicians sign and sign and sign, and then 30 years later have to sue managers for $90 million. But listen, back to the movie itself, like Paul Rudd, he's just got this extraordinary, ordinary man quality about him that people love. Not to put words in your mouth, but is that why you wanted him for this? Because he does that he could be me, but he's not kind of thing.
Yeah, he's definitely, I'd say he has a face that you can trust, which was a big part of the story, was that you kind of know that this guy, there's something about this guy that's honorable and upfront. And movies, we forget how much movies are still about faces. You know, it still is a silent gig in a way. Do you know what I mean? It's still, even though we've obviously been syncing sound up for a long time now in movies, it still works on a visual level, and we kind of know what's going on without the dialogue. Yeah. And I think Paul has a face you can trust, and I think that helps you enjoy the sort of the predicament that he's in for this movie. So yeah, no, I've always liked him and loved his movies. And he's a bit of a, I was saying this to him the other day, we were in New York doing a press junket, and I said, you kind of have the keys to the city of the many cities of Ireland. And he was like, I don't know how I got them, but I do feel like I have them. We love them here.
Yeah, we do. We do. Tell me this. John Irving, the writer, says he begins, not to pretentious it up too much, but sure, I've said it now, so I'll finish.
Yeah.
But he said that he starts every novel with the last line. Once he knows what the last line is, he can begin. And I love the end of this movie. And I'm not just saying it because you're talking to me, but there's so many movies of late, I feel, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. There's a cop out, but your ending is excellent. And I'm wondering, did you start with the ending?
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. And I like that quote. And I think it's true for me. I do like to know what the last moment is going to be, you know, the kind of the, some like it hot, nobody's perfect kind of, you know, button at the end of a movie it helps you know what the rules are. If the character is going to be here saying this thing, then the rules have to be, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, you know, the rules follow that thing. So it's a very good question. And I actually did, myself and Peter, I think very early on, I when we started working on this movie, I just had a kid, and our kid had, you start to realize that when you have a child, you don't just get a child, you kind of have a spy in the house. And
I hear that.
Yeah, it's like a KGB. It's like, you know, I found a cigarette behind a painting, behind a piece of wood that you had hidden from 3 years ago. And I'm like, Jesus, these kids. And it struck me, wouldn't it be fun if the music, the song, well, I don't want to give too much away now, but
no, like, I know.
Do you know that the songwriters record themselves all the time, but then they forget to record themselves. Wouldn't it be funny if a song was recorded on like a Fisher-Price keyboard or a, you know, one of those kind of VTech machines that records everything that kids are playing with and plays back their voice and says, hi, my name is Aoife, and you can record or whatever. I just thought that would be a kind of a funny place for like a parent musician to find what they were looking for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, we won't say any more about that because we don't want to breach into spoiler territory. But just, yeah, there is a song that is a central motif in it, and it's a great song. And, you know, if you're going to have a song doing that much work, you have to have a good song, and you have a good song. Did you co-write that?
I like to say this. I like to say that the memorable bits that you're talking about or that might go on to like get Oscar nominated belong to a man called Gary Clark. He writes all the catchy bits that we're talking about now. And the other less catchy bits that you don't remember, I'm responsible and very proud of them.
So if you should be standing on a stage in the Dolby Theatre with Gary, yes, Clark next, yes, year, let's say, you will go up as joint songwriters?
We will. We co-wrote most of the songs in the movie. But again, I have to take my hat off. The good bits are Gary's and the bits that you're not talking about now are mine. But I still get a credit.
Fantastic. That's fantastic. Talking about the larcenous music business, it's I mentioned, you know, one of the motifs, the hurt musician, a motif of all your movies at this stage is salvation in music and the power of the pop song. Are you very aware of that? That you clearly must think that music can, I don't want to say save lives, but it's really, it's the river on which we sail or something like that.
It's the, yeah, music was the thing that kind of saved me in many, many times. I mean, I don't literally mean save, but like helped me bridge the gap between fantasy and reality and, you know, have the courage to leave school, have the courage to ask a girl out, have the, you know, there was a soundtrack playing at all those key moments. And, you know, my, you know, all of my best memories from growing up as a teenager around here, there was, the, you know, The Cure were playing or Steely Dan or some piece of jazz music that my brother had brought home was playing when I had a great idea or a flash of genius at 13 that I would, you know, do whatever in life. It seems like they're just, I'm trying to relive those moments, if I'm honest. I'm trying to, in these films, I'm trying to capture, and I don't seem like I'm stopping, those kind of moments of childhood that had their own soundtrack. It's just a wonderful thing.
Yeah, well, keep at it. Tell me this, just as a sidebar, do you still have CDs and vinyl from that time?
Oh yeah, I do. Yeah. I have a lot of that stuff and cassettes.
Wow, you still have your cassettes?
I still have a few cassettes, but I do, and VHSs of films that we made, myself and Tom Hall and Peter MacDonald made films back in 1990. Actually, we were looking at them the other day and they are just like a relic. They're as old now as like kind of stuff from the 1916 Rising was to me in the 70s, you know?
Yeah, wow. Tell me this. I mentioned Flora and Son. So this is not a shameless name drop for you, but I had the pleasure of talking to Joseph Gordon-Levitt last year for Beverly Hills Cop, the new one.
Oh, brilliant.
And I also spoke to Eve Hewson and Jack Rayner on two separate occasions for a Netflix show. And I mentioned to each of them, Flora and Son, and their faces lit up. I mean, to me, that movie's kind of become a cult classic, but it didn't get the life it deserved, no. I don't think. And I think you're of the same view, are you?
Well, I think it didn't. And I think partly was the I mean, you like to blame other people for that. Maybe it's not a good enough film, but maybe it's got something to do with the two things. Eve wasn't able to promote that movie because of the actor strike. So both Eve and Joe were at home watching me on YouTube promoting the movie going, oh shit, I wish I was out there. And part of the story of that movie that I think people would have gotten their teeth into was, wow, look at Eve Hewson. She's fantastic. And she just, because of the actor's strike and it coincided with the release of the movie, nobody got to hear about it except from me. And I don't have the kind of, you know, like Joseph Gordon-Levitt's made 30 movies. You know, Eve is a up-and-coming superstar. There's a story there,
yeah,
which we didn't get to tell. And then also we sold it to Apple, so who were great, by the way, and did a terrific deal on it, and they really did do the movie. But it goes on to these streaming services, which are you know, they pay the mortgages, but they're in another way, you're like you just said, is the juice worth the squeeze? If nobody, the fun of Bachelor's Walk, because you just mentioned it there, for myself and Kieran and Tom, were being on the buses, you know, being in the conversation. You'd be getting your tooth pulled by a dentist and he'd be talking about Bachelor's Walk, or you'd be in a taxi and they'd be, and you got a sense, this is my job. I make this crap and I think it's rubbish and it gets out there and people like it or don't like it and I hear it. And that's very rewarding. It's as close as you get to like being in the theater, you know, which we're not in. But now that's just gone. I have no idea what on earth Modern Love or Flora and Son were like. I have no idea whether they mattered. I have no idea whether anybody felt anything about them. Now, Sing Street, I do, because it came out in the cinema and people responded to it. And so this is one of the things about streaming and the internet that is a big contentious issue.
So you were determined that this get a strong and big and wide and varied cinema release.
I was. Yeah, we were all, and Lionsgate have been amazing so far with the agreeing with that and seeing the movie as a kind of crowd pleasing thing that you'd want to see with your friends, not at home on a laptop. So they're giving it a good push, and hopefully it starts raining and, you know, and people will go to the cinema in Ireland again after this incredible heat wave.
Yeah, it's for praying for rain. Danny Boyle said the same thing about 28 years later last year. We got a momentary heat wave in his movie. But look, hopefully it will. I will be urging people to go and see it. Tell me this, two quick things to let you go. I'm just always curious about Once, that it goes on, it's like it is guerrilla filmmaking of the highest order, right, when you think about it. And yet it goes on to have this incredible life, like Broadway stage show. And it's a well-worn tale at this stage, but you, in essence, and maybe it goes back to the larcenous nature of entertainment, but you get nothing out of that, really, in terms of financial reward. And yet, and I'm grateful to an interview you did with Chris Wasser on this, my colleague from the Irish Independent, but you seem thoroughly unbitter, if that's even a word, about all that, and you've just chalked it down.
Yeah, you know, you make, it's like drug dealing. The first one's free. You know, and like, that's just the growing up and the learning. Myself and Glenn, when we went to promote that film, even though we had some success in Ireland, we were green, and I think we played that up to a degree, because America were like, oh my God, you guys like came from nowhere. And we're like, okay, fine. We're happy for you to believe that. We have actually worked really hard for, you know, 10 or 15 years. But we were green, and we signed deals that were nuts. Yeah. And we gave it away for free. But, you know, my advice to any musician or artist of any choice is you've just got to, you have to do a few for free.
Yeah.
And then you get a good agent or a manager, and you start to be smart, and you start to be canny, and you start to figure it out. And thankfully, by the point in which Once became a Broadway show, I had a good agent.
Yeah.
And my good agent was able to say, get me a good deal on the Broadway version of Once that we developed, which is great. Because I think I would be bitter if I hadn't done okay from that. Just being honest.
Yeah.
You know, I'm happy for the movie. And as you say, it was a low budget movie. What did I expect? But yeah, this is the struggle that all creative people have, is like, when do I start charging for the thing I love doing?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's very well put. Well, look, I'm glad the Broadway show reaped some rewards for you. Tell me this finally. I mean, the last thing you want to talk about is what you're doing next, because Power Ballad is very much on the boil. But is it another movie after this?
Yeah, definitely. I have a few things on the boil, and which one will kind of boil over, as such, to continue the metaphor, depends on what Power Ballad does.
Okay.
Francois Truffaut, the director, famously said, you know, each movie is about the movie you just made.
Yeah.
And I think what that means is you make a movie and you see how it does, and you see how people respond to it, and you pivot then according to that. For me, that's the way I've always worked. So Power Ballad was a reaction to Once, in a sense. And I remember ringing my agents and saying, this is the movie I want to put everything behind now, because it's such a different experience from Flora and Son, and let's get movie stars and pop stars in it, and let's kind of go for it. So I may go back and, you know, ring Glenn and Marquette and say, do you want to make the sequel to Once now on my iPhone?
Let's see. Well, listen, I have never seen a movie or a TV show of yours that I haven't liked. His latest movie, Power Ballad, is in cinemas from this Friday, the 29th of May. Go and see it in the cinema. Hopefully it will be there for a long time. John Carney, always a pleasure. Thanks a million.
Thank you very much.
See how to write a song about you. How to sing the words that ring true.
You should keep the how to write a song going every time.
How to write a song without you. Cause every song I ever wrote in my life, it's about you.
So good. So good. Okay, so do you have a bridge yet?
No, man, I've been working on that. That thing's dogging me for years.
We could finish this right now.
I wish. No, I can't. I gotta go. My daughter has got to get to school.
Wait.
My wife has work, and if I'm not hauling to take her, she's gonna skin my balls.
A clip there from Power Ballad, the new film by John Carney, starring Paul Rudd and Nick Jonas. And it is in cinemas, as I say. And I'm a big fan of John Carney, as you heard there. He's got his own way of doing things. He's just been making movies about musicians in various guises. And hats off to him. So do check out Power Ballad in cinemas. Do check out Flora and Son as well, if you have Apple TV, a great watch also. But Power Ballad is the one to go and see in the cinema. Up next, a new Hollywood. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, the emergence of films such as Bonnie and Clyde in 1967 and The Thomas Crown Affair, which was quite a sexually charged movie for the time, signaled a shift in mainstream American cinema. And then a new Hollywood began. It continued in the 70s, where sacred cows continued to fall as Chinatown tackled corruption amongst the wealthy elite. 3 Days of the Condor captured the mood of the country post-Nixon. And I suppose network savaged the role of the media in contemporary American society. These films also saw the emergence of a new class actor, many of them who became iconic, such as Warren Beatty, Robert Redford, and of course, Faye Dunaway. There was a whole new season at the IFI dedicated to some of these movies and more, called The New Hollywood, and it runs from the 6th of June. And I'm delighted to say that cinema programmer at the IFI, Kevin Coyne, joins me now. Kevin, hello, how are you?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So, you know, we hear this phrase, New Hollywood. People like me and people who fill column inches kind of get obsessed with this kind of stuff. But is Bonnie and Clyde kind of the moment in the calendar where we can point to and say this is probably where it all kind of started?
In as much as you could point to any one film, it's certainly a strong contender. I mean, in the 60s, throughout the 50s and the 60s in American cinema, you'd had the breakup of the vertical integration model at the end of the 40s. So this idea that studios could blockbook their own films into cinemas was gone. Mm-hmm. So they had to look beyond what they were making themselves. Television was coming in, which was another thing that, you know, they had to find a way to keep audiences and to bring audiences into cinemas. So throughout the 50s, you had kind of gimmicks. You had 3D and VistaVision and all these kind of different things that were being used to try and draw people back. Meanwhile, in Europe, you had the Nouvelle Vague in France, and you had neorealism in Italy, and you had all these new styles of cinema emerging. And so then it kind of was a little bit late in coming to America, but Bonnie and Clyde is one of those films that kind of adopted a more European approach to storytelling and took on topics in terms of its violence and its content that, you know, American cinema goers weren't really used to. So it is a very key film in that kind of shift from a kind of a safe mode of cinema to something very different.
Yeah, well, that's very well described. I notice when we go down through a lot of these movies, I think nearly all the ones that are going to be in your season, Faye Dunaway is, I think, in every one of them. So clearly, you know, you guys are saying this lady mattered a huge amount.
She did. I mean, Faye Dunaway has done some incredible work, you know, across the films in this season. And she is someone worth celebrating. And she brought a new kind of character to film. I think that this kind of the icy control that she displays in a lot of these films. Again, the style of character she was playing is interesting. She become this kind of, you always had the kind of the Betty Davis, the Joan Crawfords, the kind of high melodrama, but she brought a realism to it and grounded it. And the brittle persona she often masked under this ice control, it was again, back to an earlier point, more of a European style. And she was really interesting in the choices that she made in this period. She would do kind of a film like Bonnie and Clyde, then she would work with Vittorio De Sica. Then she would, you know, she did work with some really key European film directors as well. Mm. And I think that makes her a very interesting character in American cinema, that she wasn't purely interested in being a star. She was genuinely interested in the work and wanted to work with the best people. And I think that made then for some incredible films like Network or 3 Days of the Condor.
Yeah, or Chinatown. So, like, I mean, we could do a whole show, a whole series of shows on Chinatown. But I mean, it's, you know, it contains multitudes. But in terms of, you know, this new Hollywood, like, I still to this day remember kind of the end of that and the kind of despair of that movie. Like, it really is a dark film, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I can't think of another mainstream Hollywood film that tackled incest and, you know, portrayed the elite as feckless, ruthless, and just corrupt as they were. And, you know, whether or not that has continued is certainly a topic for discussion. But it is a unique film in that respect. And again, having a European director, maybe bringing a sensibility that was not so grounded in an obeisance to authority.
Yeah.
It just made for, I mean, Chinatown is a classic.
And you can see it on the big screen in the IFI as part of the IFI's season, The New Hollywood or New Hollywood, which I'm talking to about with Kevin Coyne here, the cinema programmer at the IFI. Now, you mentioned Network. I mean, it's probably very obvious to say it, but, you know, it's a movie about, you know, media and the famous line, I'm just not going to take it anymore or whatever. It's probably as relevant today, if not more so. So I presume it was a no-brainer to put this on the list.
Absolutely. I mean, again, it has a prescience that's kind of disturbing when you look back at it. Mm-hmm. The mixture of base capitalism in it, ruthlessness again, the media's role in shaping society, what it uses to shape society, how it's the different perspectives it can take on things. You know, as the film Network progresses, it brings in these religious elements that it becomes, you know, into the character as he speaks to the audience. Yeah. And it's a multi-layered film that is probably even more fascinating now than it was in the 70s.
Yeah. And if I have a small gripe, I really think Easy Rider should be in there. But look, you're the programmer, but I guess maybe there just wasn't room. Because I would suggest Easy Rider is as much a part of New Hollywood as something like Chinatown. But you tell me.
No, I absolutely agree. Unfortunately, you can't show everything.
Indeed.
But I would absolutely agree that Easy Rider is another key film. I mean, Easy Rider, I think, won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, which shows things. It's an interesting kind of boomerang that these American films, so influenced by European cinema, suddenly come back to the home of European cinema and are so fated. So I think Easy Rider, again, is an absolutely fascinating film. It stands as a really interesting snapshot of a society in turmoil, you know, the late 60s America with the civil rights movement and so much else going on. It really does stand, but unfortunately, there's not always room to show everything we'd love to show.
No, indeed, indeed. And I'm sure someone like you drowns in all these titles. And you mentioned, you know, Faye Dunaway, you know, as kind of a new type of actor. But what was it about these actors like Robert Redford, like Warren Beatty, and I suppose like even Jack Nicholson in Chinatown? I guess they were, you know, it wasn't method, but they were... Acting was becoming something different. It was almost like a life choice as opposed to a job or something like that. But what's your take on that?
In terms of what they do on screen, I think part of it is that they were a break from previous Hollywood cinema in that they were not afraid to be unlikable.
Yeah.
They were not afraid to portray characters who were flawed, beyond flawed, who were, you know, bad people, essentially, in different films. Or who were confused or unsure, or, you know, and I think that was really significant, that this was a crop of actors, not so much, you know, maybe someone like Brando was willing to explore it, but this crop of actors moved away from the actor's studio kind of method thing. Mm. And just, you know, we're more grounded. We're just playing people, people that the audience could recognize because they were, you know, it was representation in a more accurate way than, you know, some of the melodramas of the 40s or the spectacles of the 50s were.
It is a season called New Hollywood, which is going to be at the IFI from the 6th of June. You can see quite literally some of the greatest movies ever made, including the aforementioned Chinatown, Bonnie and Clyde, The Thomas Crown Affair, Network, Mommy Dearest, Barfly, 3 Days of the Condor. Kevin, just as I have you there in closing, you've never been on the show before. You are the cinema programmer at the IFI. That must be an exciting job, but one that must, I don't know, keep you awake at night. I mean, to decide what you're going to put in a cinema, I'm assuming is no easy feat.
No, but it is so much fun. It is a fantastic job and I enjoy it very much. And as you say, sometimes, yes, drowning in films, drowning in ideas. You know, when I meet people for the first time, they always have suggestions, which is absolutely fine. It's a lot of fun. So I can't really complain too much.
No, indeed. And I know from my own work here on a film show, no one is going to give you any sympathy for saying, I have to watch movies all day. Kevin Coyne, cinema programmer at the IFI. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A clip there from Power Ballad, the new film by John Carney, starring Paul Rudd and Nick Jonas. And it is in cinemas, as I say. And I'm a big fan of John Carney, as you heard there. He's got his own way of doing things. He's just been making movies about musicians in various guises, and hats off to him. So do check out Power Ballad in cinemas. Do check out Flora and Son as well if you have Apple TV, a great watch also. But Power Ballad is the one to go and see in the cinema. Up next, A New Hollywood. Kevin Coyne there from the IFI, talking about the IFI's upcoming season, A New Hollywood, all about some of those great movies that, well, introduce New Hollywood. You can find out more information on ifi.ie. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch with me, you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. We'll do something a little different on the show next week. Best Kept Secret TV. Yes, we're going to be looking with my esteemed panel at some great TV shows you may have missed. Cult TV shows, let's call them, for want of a better phrase. Leave you with a little music from the movies. And John Carney was talking about working with Gary Clark earlier. Gary Clark, he of Danny Wilson fame. And this is their biggest hit from lots of movies. So I leave you with Mary's Prayer by Danny Wilson and wish you a happy remainder to your long weekend.
Everything is wonderful. Being here is heavenly. Every single day she sends, everything is free. I used to be so careless, as if I couldn't care.